Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and the chair of this program. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and other noise-making devices. Now, let me tell you about some of the upcoming health and medicine events at the club. On Thursday, July 22nd, Dr. Thomas Frieden, director of the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention and administrator, Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, will speak on combating and preventing disease at home and abroad. That's a 6 p.m. Program here. On August 18th, Carol Baggerly, the principal behind grassrootshealth.org, will be speaking on the benefits of vitamin D and what she's doing in her own organization to spread the word. You may or may not know that the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies is due to make new recommendations on vitamin D in September. We've been pushing them as hard as we can. My field of research is vitamin D, and so I've been pushing as hard as I can, and we'll just have to see what happens in September, how far they push the envelope. But 400 IU per day is just not sufficient. You need 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 or more IUs per day to really have good health. So those are just a couple of the upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of events. You may register for these programs online at thecommonwealthclub.org or the club's 24-hour reservation line. We're going to make this informal tonight. It is being recorded, and I hope this will be at least a podcast at the club's website. And we will have questions asked by microphone, which I'll pass around the audience, so we can have a more interactive exchange that way, and you don't have to write down your questions. Now, let me introduce our moderator, who will then introduce the panel, and we'll go from there. We'll have about a half-hour formal presentation or interaction between them. Then we'll open for another half hour or more with the audience. So Nancy Milliken has a MD degree. She's vice dean of the University of California SF School of Medicine and director of UCSF's National Center of Excellence in Women's Health. In 1996, Dr. Milliken led a multidisciplinary team at UCSF in successfully competing for one of the first National Centers of Excellence in Women's Services. Women's Health COE designation by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Under her leadership, the COE has developed partnership within UCSF and with the communities it serves to advance research in women's health, create models of comprehensive clinical care, promote partnerships with individual women and their communities on issues relevant to their health, design women's health curricula to train the next generation of researchers and clinicians, and develop leadership opportunities for women. Dr. Milliken is dedicated to the mentoring of women contemplating or currently pursuing careers in the health professions, and she supported widespread improvements in leadership development for women in research and academic programs, community education, and clinical care, including programs for young women in high school and college. In 2002, she earned the UCSF Chancellor's Award for the Advancement of Women. Dr. Milliken received her MD from Duke University after a BA from Harvard University and 2 years of pre-medical studies at Stanford University. Following her OBGYN residency at Pennsylvania Hospital, she was awarded a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholarship during which she studied medical ethics as it relates to reproductive health. Dr. Milliken.
Well, thank you very much for being here tonight. And I'm joined by two fabulous women on this panel who bring differing experiences, perspectives to this issue of menopause, the treatment of menopause, the use of hormones in women's health, and I know I'm going to learn a lot along with you. So I wanted to start by giving you a little bit of their background. Then I want to learn a little bit about who's in the audience so we know who's here tonight. And then they will each speak for a little bit. And then I hope, we all hope, that most of this will be questions and answers, so we're sure we're providing you with the information that you came for tonight. So Marcia Stefanik, who's right here to my left, earned her PhD in physiology from Stanford University, where she also did a postdoctoral fellow in cardiovascular disease prevention. Her research has been widely disseminated both on a national and an international level and focuses on chronic disease prevention, meaning heart disease, breast cancer, osteoporosis, and recently dementia, both in women and men. Currently, her primary research interests are sex hormones and lifestyle, in other words, diet, exercise, weight control, and the impact on these chronic conditions, and also sex and gender differences in human physiology and disease, menopause, and healthy aging. I can tell you that she has been involved in practically every study on menopause and hormones and chronic disease. And in specific, she's been the chair of the Women's Health Initiative, the WHI Steering Committee and Executive Committee since 1998. And so was very involved in that trial that brought about the real sea change in our understanding of how hormones should be used and prescribed. In addition to this, in her spare time, she does a lot of teaching at Stanford and is involved in a lot of multidisciplinary programs to advance women's health. But I'm not going to list all those. Sitting next to her is Dr. Scirocco Sokitch, who is trained as an MD and also as an acupuncturist. She has done in her past some surgical training and spent 10 years working in emergency medicine in the hospitals on the West Coast. But her real passion that I've learned in talking with her is blending Chinese and Western medicine, which she has been developing and doing for 20 years. She now treats women and men, I believe, in private practice in this area, and she describes her practice as a unique blend of Chinese and Western medicine that allows her to treat her patient as a whole person, helping the individual to find what it takes to heal their bodies in a balanced way. She'll describe for us later her healing path, which she calls 20-30-50, which is about finding a balance of all the components of oneself for healing. In addition, she's taken her knowledge and philosophy of healing to the public through both a newspaper column and a TV show. And as a result of the show, they've created Stop Revolving, Start Evolving seminars, which have been very, very successful. So we'll learn about those when she talks with us later. So I thought I would start tonight with a couple of definitions. And the first is, what is menopause? And menopause, physiologically, is when the ovaries stop producing estrogen and progesterone, and as a result, the menstrual cycle stops in women. The actual clinical definition that gives you the diagnosis of being in menopause is having stopped having menstrual bleeding for 12 consecutive months. So that's fairly simple and clear cut. However, the experience of going through menopause is nothing simple and not clear cut. And just the way that puberty, when the reproductive systems and the ovaries start working in women, isn't an on-off switch, and it comes on gradually and often erratically and somewhat turbulent. The turning off of the reproductive system can also be very variable and very different from woman to woman. A lot, traditionally, estrogen was used to treat this, and so in fact, because of that widespread use of estrogen, we do not actually know a lot about the physiology of the symptoms, the hot flashes, the night sweats, the vaginal dryness, the sleep disruption, the mood swings, because people were treated as opposed to being studied. The Women's Health Initiative has changed that because it's changed our views of the risk and benefits of hormone therapy. And therefore, I think there is a new look at what is this experience, what's actually happening, and therefore, what are some alternative treatments that we can propose and use and study. And again, these my colleagues have experience with that, both in the clinic as well as in research. Before I turn it over for perspective to start with the panel, I'd like to ask you in the audience, how many of you in the audience consider yourself either have gone through menopause? I'll raise my hand in that group. How many of you are in that period that we call perimenopause, which sort of encapsulates when the symptoms start, but they're not quite finished? How many of you at any point in time have taken hormones for the symptoms of menopause? And how many of you were taking hormones and went off of them when the Women's Health Initiative came out? Okay, well, that is really great to know, because that gives us a sense of who we have in the audience. So thank you for sharing that. I'm going to turn it over to Marcia to start out with and to ask her, given her long experience in the research of this, if she would talk a little bit about the history of our understanding of estrogen, how we sort of went through a cycle of seeing it as a benefit to the point where we were really prescribing it for prevention to women who had no symptoms, and what was the data and evidence that caused us from the Women's Health Initiative to see things very differently at this point in time. And what I want to emphasize and what I've asked her to address first is not the use of hormones for treatment of symptoms, but this use of hormones for prevention of chronic disease. So if you could help us with that.
Thank you. So the first thing I want to say is that's a very important distinction, because we've really got into the issue of menopause is something that's happening to women between 45 and 55, plus minus 5 years. I think we're kind of expanding it now. And when we're talking about preventing these diseases of aging, we're talking about women who are generally 60 and over. So we had gotten to the point where, and I can tell you the very first paper was in 1983 that was suggesting that hormones might prevent heart disease. And I remember I was just finishing my graduate training and felt like, I'm going to go study this, because it came out kind of as a controversy. And the first study was something called PEPI, which was really just looking at risk factors for heart disease, but also looked at bones. And it came out with kind of a mixed picture, but it got spun in a way where it all looked positive. And I realized right then that when you're dealing with the pharmaceutical companies, you're going to get results spun in a way that always sells the product. But those of us in cardiovascular disease were trying to understand, really, is this the right thing to do or not? And the next big study that we did really run from UCSF with Deb Grady, who's a colleague of ours, was called the HER study, which was looking at women with heart disease to see if, in fact, the hormones would prevent a second cardiovascular event. But the reason that we were getting to this, where we were actually doing these trials, was that the observational studies, which are studies where women are just doing what they're doing, if we took a sample of you and we asked who's on hormones, who's not, who took them before, who didn't, and then we started to follow you over time to see what happened to you, what we were seeing is that women who were saying, I'm on hormones, I've been on them a long time, in fact had fewer heart attacks over the course of the time. And so we got this hypothesis that it would really prevent heart disease. And then when we did the Women's Health Initiative, it turned out not to be true, particularly with respect to combination therapy. So there are, I've mentioned to Dr. Milliken, that there's two very important issues in terms of hormones. One is that if you have a uterus, you're going to take estrogen and progestin, because you want to prevent cancer of the uterus, which would happen if you took just estrogen. But if you've had a hysterectomy, then you would only take estrogen. And often when you get a hysterectomy, you also have your ovaries removed. And often you get estrogen right away when you get your ovaries removed. So we have very different hormone histories of these two kinds of women. And the 12 months past your last menstrual bleed really only applies to if you have a uterus, because we can't tell. And that's where you have to go into follicle-stimulating hormone and some of the other tests. But at any rate, we were very clear that these two populations and these two hormones were not coming up with exactly the same data. And to just quickly say that the medical community firmly believed that hormones were beneficial for heart disease prevention, and we had even better data for bone to suggest that it might really prevent loss of bone, but we didn't actually have data to say that it prevented fractures, and we didn't really have data to say that it did prevent heart disease. And so the Women's Health Initiative was launched with 30% of the study were women in their 50s, so relatively recent postmenopausal women, although many of them had had these hysterectomies and oophorectomies years before that, and then a large group of women that were 60 and over, looking at the issues of prevention. And I'll just jump to the chase and say that, you know, our hypotheses were wrong, that when we looked at the women on estrogen and progestin, we saw more heart attacks, more strokes, more serious blood clots in the lungs and the legs. We studied a group of women that were 65 and over within that group, and we actually saw twice as much dementia develop. So all of our hypotheses about hormones for older women were wrong. Now, an interesting issue is that because we were believing this was going to be preventive, the medical community was really using hormones in what I'll call off-label use. The FDA indication is for menopause symptoms, and it's very good for treating menopause symptoms. There are alternatives, which you'll hear about. But when we talk about prevention, there was no FDA indication for prevention except for preventing bone loss, not for preventing fractures. And so basically, when this study came out, we had a lot of women in their 60s and 70s whose physicians were putting them on hormones even though they were way past menopause and no longer having hot flushes by and large. And really, there was no good reason. And they would come to us and they'd say, my doctor wants to put me on hormones to prevent heart disease. Should I do it? And we said, I don't know. That's why we're doing the study. And you have a 50% chance of getting a hormone, which is what your doctor's encouraging you to do, and you have a 50% chance of getting placebo, which must be what you want to do. You're not ready to change your life and go on these hormones. So it was actually quite easy to recruit 27,000 women into that study for what they thought was going to be 8 years. But in fact, we stopped the first study, the estrogen and progestin study, 3 years short of 8 years. In 2002, that was the big boom when you probably all start hearing about there's some study that says that estrogen's not good. It was estrogen and progestin that wasn't good. And in addition to all those cardiovascular problems and the dementia, it increased breast cancer. And we're very convinced now that estrogen and progestin together increase breast cancer. There's no question in my mind. The problem, then, is that in the estrogen-only study, which was women who had these oophorectomies, many of them fit 40%, but had hysterectomies, estrogen alone did not show the same results, and that has not been well disseminated. In particular, we did not see increased heart attacks in that group of women. We actually did not see increased breast cancer in that group of women. We did see increased strokes, and we did see increased dementia. So some of the results were consistent. In both groups, it was very clear that fractures were reduced, and so it was beneficial to bone. And so we end up with this mixed story of risk and benefit for these hormones, but what really then made us all stop was this reaction, but what about menopause? And it's like, well, we were focusing on prevention, which is something that relates to the population. It doesn't relate to individual by individual as much as, is this really going to benefit most women? And the answer was no, it's not going to benefit most women, even though it may not harm the estrogen-only women. So I'll just say that that's kind of a good segue to what do we do about menopause. And I will tell you, we had quite a few women that were in their 50s, so we've looked at the issue of younger women. We don't see any evidence of benefit at all for younger women on the combination of estrogen and progestin. But there was just enough of a signal on estrogen only. So these are these women who really had been through menopause probably 10 years earlier because they had had hysterectomies and many of them had oophorectomies, that it at least didn't look as dangerous and there was the suggestion. So it's something that now they're calling the timing hypothesis. And again, the marketing is really much trying to get younger women to think that they're going to benefit for prevention when, in fact, what I'd really like to make as my point is we have to separate prevention and use of hormones for that purpose from menopause and managing these symptoms. So with that, I'm going to stop and pass it over.
Okay. Wow. Where to start? So I'll start talking about how I practice medicine and how I view treating menopause, because I've been doing this for 20 years and I've been dealing with hundreds and hundreds of women who have had menopausal symptoms, some who even start at age 35. So in Chinese medicine, the idea is that you're made up of energy and that energy travels through your body in certain patterns. And when your energy is out of balance, there are problems. And there's this whole concept of yin and yang. Have you guys heard of yin and yang? So yin energy is feminine, moist, cool, nighttime energy. And the masculine energy is yang. It's masculine, daytime, bright, hot, shiny energy. And they alternate throughout the day, so that that beautiful drawing that so many of you have seen is really a representation of how energy moves. It's constantly changing, constantly shifting, and the little circles that are inside each of them is that one can change into the other. At menopause, what happens, so throughout the day, the energy shifts and cycles, and in the Chinese description, what happens at menopause is that the yin energy drops. And so you were asking about hot flashes, which is why I'm explaining this. As the yin energy drops, the yang energy is relatively excessive, and it may not be completely excessive, but at a time of day when the yin energy is supposed to come up so that you can sleep at night, it doesn't come up because it's gone. And the yang energy is relatively still there, so you get hot flashes, you get heat at a time of day when you shouldn't. So that's the theory in Chinese medicine about why you get hot flashes. For people who measure their hormone levels, or when you start having symptoms, sometimes you don't necessarily see a shift in their hormones. Like the classic measure of menopause is measuring a brain chemical called LH and FSH to see if you're in menopause. And a lot of women come to me and they say, well, my doctor says I'm not in menopause, but I'm having hot flashes, or I feel really unstable, or I can't sleep at night, or I feel bloated. There's this long list of symptoms that people tend to have. And so this is where I come in with, well, there's this long list of possible treatments that can make a person feel better before they get to the very thing that's called menopause, or by the definition of menopause, and you can feel so much better doing certain things. So first of all, the very first thing I do is look at your diet, your exercise, what are you eating, what are you doing for exercise, because those things in and of themselves alone will change how you feel. There are some people that come in to see me and all I do is give them omega fatty acids and they feel better in a month. Because omega fatty acids can make your hormones function better. They can make your brain chemistry function better. They can make you feel better in your whole body. Same with vitamin D. They're kind of similar in their effect. Vitamin D can be used to help balance all your hormones, your brain chemistry, your skin. And so starting with the very basics, I look at how you eat, how you exercise. Sometimes exercise can change whether you feel bad or not, you know. Then we go, like, it's sort of this progression of looking at what does it take to get into balance. And the next level would be acupuncture. So if you're feeling poorly and you're already eating well and you're already exercising and you're taking your omega fatty acids and maybe some good multivitamin, then I start thinking, well, maybe we can use acupuncture to help you. So then I give you acupuncture. And if that doesn't work, then there's herbs. And there's a long list of herbs. I like to joke that if you have a symptom, I have an herb for it. And it's not entirely true. There are some things that you can't fix with herbs, but there are so many different herbs, that especially herbs that help with menopausal symptoms. For example, one herb that is not actually a Chinese herb is called maca. Have you heard of maca? It's in the Brazilian rainforest, and it's an adaptogen, and adaptogens are herbs that literally, they're almost psychic. They know what you need, so that when you take them, they help you adapt to your environment. That's why they're called adaptogens. Or they help you adapt to your whole life. And maca has been helpful for women. Like, I've taken care of women. There was one woman that I took care of, and she had had hot flashes for 10 years. And she had not wanted to take hormones. And I think even at one point she did take hormones, and she had such bad side effects from them that she couldn't stand to take them. So she had acupuncture. It didn't work that well for her. And finally we gave her maca, and it completely solved her problem. Different people have different responses. And so, as Marcia was saying, you know, in a big study where there's hundreds of people or thousands of people, we're looking at what's going on in the culture or in the whole outcome. But when I'm seeing you, I'm looking at you, one person at a time, and I'm treating the person in front of me individually according to what's going on with you, you know. And so I use the research and the studies sort of as the big picture of the relationship of what I'm going to do, but I'm looking at you and what's going to make you feel better. That's why I spent, when I went to surgery residency, that's why I went to surgery residency, is because I wanted to make things better. I'm a person who likes to make people feel better and intervene. And so I ended up with acupuncture for the same reason, because I could see results. And that is the basis of how I practice medicine, is to find what will work for an individual, that will work for you as a person. Maca is one of the few herbs that I give as an individual herb for menopausal symptoms. In Chinese medicine, the traditional way of giving herbs is not to give one herb by itself, but to balance the effect of each herb. And it's the same as the yin and yang symbol, where the dance of energy is to give you herbs that will help the yin and to balance the yang and to just create a specific perfect effect. And there are several formulas that are really amazing for balancing menopausal symptoms, which is a long discussion, and I can't go into it right now, but it's enough to say that there are many, many options. Again, like, if you have trouble sleeping, there are herbs that help that. There are herbs that help with the hot flashes. There are herbs that help with the moodiness. I haven't had great luck with the vaginal dryness using Chinese herbs. So maybe there's an herb that, I mean, there are creams and things like that, but am I out of time?
Oh, I think, let me just ask you, I want a wanted you to have an opportunity to talk about the 20-30-50 approach.
Okay.
And then I think those of you in the audience, if you start thinking about what specific questions you have, will get your voice in the room and work off of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So over the 20 years that I've been practicing this blend of Chinese and Western medicine, and really it's fully a blend when I see somebody, I'm doing both. I'm doing a Chinese exam, which is feeling your pulse and looking at your tongue, and it tells me about 12 organs and what's happening to your energy. But I'm also doing a Western exam, listening to your heart and lungs, checking your blood pressure, looking at all the factors that are taken into account in a Western way. If you need blood tests, if you need labs, I do those labs. And then I put all that information together to create a plan that helps you heal. And so over the years, I've developed this, what I call a philosophy, what I look at as a philosophy of how everything connects. So I call that my 20-30-50 healing path. And what the 20 is 20% of anything that you need to heal a condition is physical. So you need a doctor or surgery or acupuncture or some sort of treatment, some physical intervention. 30% is your lifestyle, what you eat, how you exercise, what supplements you take, what you do within your life that will help you feel balanced. And 50% of what it takes to heal a physical condition is actually emotional or spiritual. And this is why I love Chinese medicine, because in Chinese medicine, how each organ works is a balance of the emotional, the physical, and the spiritual. And each organ has physical functions that we don't have in Western medicine, emotional and spiritual functions that we don't consider in Western medicine. And so I love that whole big picture of looking at something.
And I actually think what you're talking about is this looking holistically at somebody in front of you is actually what's coming out of the research, that with this singular focus on kind of the one pill that could provide the fountain of youth, which estrogen had in some ways been thought of and would be the easiest solution to things. I think we're now looking in many, many ways and studying many ways that we can find a better path for longevity and quality of life. And I think you've been involved now in studies on diet and exercise, and you may want to make a comment.
Well, I will say I think one of the real problems that we have in Western medicine is that we don't look at the whole person. So we used to look at estrogen just for bones, and then we started adding heart disease, and then we started adding cancer, and then we started adding dementia. And so one of the interesting things is that when you take something that is as powerful as a sex hormone, and now there's lots of research on testosterone showing up, when you take something as powerful as that that affects all these systems, you have to get into risks and benefits. You have to realize that this pill is going everywhere. It's not just going to go and take care of my tooth or my toe. It's going to go everywhere, and it may affect my skin. We don't actually have any good data on that yet, by the way, but it may affect all these things, and I think that's a really important place that we have to start when we think about menopause, having those estrogens drop. They don't always just drop, so the point that Scirocco made is true, that we're actually now doing, I'm not doing this, but there's a big study called Study of Women Across the Nation, which is following a bunch of women through menopause and realizing that the estrogen levels are not predicting very well who has the worst symptoms, that there's a lot of other things that are predicting that. So, for instance, we used to think that women who were carrying extra body weight would have fewer hot flushes because we thought they had higher estrogen, but what we actually learned is they have more hot flushes, probably because it's like an insulation and they can't get rid of the body heat. So we're slowly realizing that we need to have a much broader comprehension about what is going on when we take a pill and how many systems. So the holistic approach, I think, is coming back around. And I think the question you really wanted to know is about diet and exercise, and I feel like we just don't have good enough data on menopause and diet and exercise. Now, the great thing is when you take one woman at a time, you can keep working through that. But when you're trying to come up with some message that's for everybody, that's when you have to do the research and try and figure out, okay, X percent of women are probably going to react like that, but you're always going to have the individual that needs individual approaches. And so I think that's the dilemma that the medical profession is in, and it's certainly a good reason that you have to keep doing this evidence-based medicine.
Well, thank you. Do we have a mic?
Can I get your opinions on bioidenticals?
I just said the first question is going to be bioidentical, which I know it hurts.
We were just explain saying we never got to bioidentical hormones, so I'll explain it. Okay, so bioidentical hormones are hormones that are synthesized in a laboratory, so they're not quote unquote natural. You can't eat soybeans or eat what are they called? Yams.
The South African or South American yams.
You can't eat a wild yam, and you can't eat enough soybeans to get a hormone out of them. But what happens is that your body generates certain hormones, and they look a certain way in the lab. And when you take bioidentical hormones, the hormones that you are given are biologically exactly the same as the hormones that your body makes naturally, as opposed to the study that was done was using Premarin, which is horse urine, and progestin, which is a chemical progesterone that is not bioidentical. It's not biologically the same as yours. Now, I don't know the big research about it, so I'll let her talk about that. But in my philosophy and in my experience, when I do end up giving a woman hormones, I give her bioidentical hormones, and I tend to give it in the form of a cream, because the idea is that if you take it as a cream, it doesn't go through your liver, doesn't tend to be altered in your body into something that could cause cancer. So the theory is that there's a less risk for cancer when you're using bioidentical hormones. Again, that's not my area of expertise, it's yours, and I have good experience with it. So and I only really give it for people with symptoms. So if you're suffering miserably and the herbs and the acupuncture aren't working, I'm going to give you hormones, and I'm going to give you bioidentical hormones, and if that works, great. But I'm always looking for the lowest dose of anything that will work, and I'm always looking the least side effects. So the idea is that you don't want to suffer any side effects when you're taking something in order to feel better. You want to be feeling better without problems. You want to answer too?
So I'll just address the ones that you mentioned. So there are estrogens that are bioidentical in the sense like esterase. There are estradiol. You can get pure estradiol. So there are a lot of pure hormones that are prescribed in kind of the normal way. The bioidentical is the main claim is that they're safer, and that's where I feel that you have to do research before you make that claim. And it'll be true that in an individual practice, very few physicians are going to see the side effects, because you're not going to get cancer right away. You really can't even see, although our study showed that the breast cancers for estrogen with progestin, and it was that estrogen and that progestin, you know, showed up at 5 years. Some women clearly got it sooner. Many women got it later. But when you're doing 100,000 women, actually we had 27,000 women, you see it, because of the numbers. So a big problem with medical practice, the one-on-one approach, is you're working on the symptoms the individual's doing, but you're not going to be able to see enough to get the full sense of risks and benefits. So the problem I have with bioidentical is we just don't have the research. So I think she's got the experience that it works for the symptoms. We actually have the experience that even estrogen and progestin, when you're talking about young women, so women in their 50s, I like to call them young now, women in their 50s are at very low risk for a lot of these things, so the likelihood that you're going to see any kind of risk is low, unless she's got really bad genetics. And the question that I was just going to address...
Let me chime in there. The other thing that we can look at about do natural hormones put you at risk of breast cancer is to look at the data that shows that women who have a higher estrogen load in their bodies, whether it's because the estrogen conversion in women who are heavier than those who are not, those studies show that for women who carry more weight, they have less osteoporosis, which is probably a benefit of the conversion to estrogen naturally in their bodies, and they have higher breast cancer rates. So I'm not sure that the natural, I agree that we need to test that. The problem is that testing it is really expensive. How much did the Women's Health Initiative cost?
Probably $250 million.
Oh, yeah.
So but it was a huge study for a long time.
Yeah. And
it saved that much for the population.
And it gave us a lot of data that can now be used by individual women to make choices to weigh the positives and the negatives between symptoms relief versus potential risk, or to know that we can use this if needed, but use it for the shortest amount of time. So it was definitely worth the investment, but you're not going to get that investment over and over again, most likely, unless we could convince the federal government to do this, to study absolutely everything. So I think what you're hearing here is that the message is not, don't ever, ever consider taking hormones. The message is when you're considering taking hormones, you have to do it with a degree of understanding what the data is and weighing the risks and benefits, and doing it in conjunction with other things that can help with the symptom relief. And I think that's consistent across what those of us up here are saying. I think that's one of the messages from this. And it's interesting. What's interesting is the shift that happened in believing, based on a certain kind of research data, that these things were good, and then doing the more rigorous study and learning where we took out some of the variables that we call confounders. We really control for things, and finding out that we were wrong. And that to me is a very important message for all of us when we're looking at data, and that we understand what kind of data it is and how good it is in terms of giving us information about what's risky and what's beneficial.
I agree with her. So the question here is, can you elaborate on the risks and benefits of estrogen hormone delivery, pill versus patch? And actually, Scirocco introduced that concept by talking about creams, because the issue with any kind of drug is if it goes through your mouth, it's going to go through into your liver, and the liver is very metabolically, biochemically different from it coming in other routes, and it will trigger certain kinds of inflammatory responses. It will change your cholesterol profile. Up to this time, having estrogen go through, or prior to WHI, I guess, having estrogen go through the liver was believed to be good because it actually increased HDL cholesterol, the so-called good cholesterol, and decreased LDL cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol. But in the end, it didn't prevent heart disease. So what we learned is that you can't just completely hold on to a laboratory value and say, if this goes up, it's good, and if that goes down, it's bad. You have to figure out what made it go up and what made it go down. So the effect of diet and exercise on HDL and LDL is quite different from the effect of estrogen. So when we talk about a pill versus patch, the principle of the patch is that it's going to come in through your skin and go into a slightly different circulatory system. It doesn't make it right to the liver. It kind of spreads out everywhere, much as the creams. And so it's safer in the sense of it's not triggering those liver reactions, so you don't get these inflammatory kinds of problems that we're concerned about, and you don't get a rise in what we call triglycerides, which are the fatty acids in the blood that we know estrogen causes an increase. So there's been a lot of interest in, is the patch safer than the pill? It's lower dose, so part of it might just be that you're getting less hormone exposure by taking a patch. So it's a question, same with creams. One problem I have with creams is that unless a woman really knows how to put it on, she could put on too much. So monitoring the dose is a really important thing, which I'm sure Scirocco helps you do that the right way.
Yeah.
Can someone speak to Dr. John Lee and how he alleviated symptoms using a more natural progesterone cream without having any extra estrogens?
Dr. Lee's cream? Well, actually, I've read that book very carefully, and I've gone back to see every reference, and none of them match up. So he didn't actually do the research. That said, there's a lot of anecdotal information from women that they really love it. So we don't have good research, but you probably know more about Dr. Lee's cream.
I do.
I can just tell you that it's not research-based, even though he claims it is.
Are you going to say something? She wants to hear.
Do you want to hear about Dr. Lee's? So Dr. Lee is a guy who is actually in Sonoma County, and that's where my practice has been for 17 years, and now my practice is in Novato. But anyway, he was pretty well known up there, and so I heard a lot about progesterone cream, and you can buy progesterone cream over the counter. And so a lot of women have tried it, or a lot of women have asked me about it. And in my experience, it kind of depends, because progesterone in the chain of production of hormones, progesterone is higher, and so his theory is that in the adrenal hormones, the chain of production of hormones, it starts with cholesterol, and then the first hormone is pregnenolone, and the second hormone made by the adrenals is progesterone. And then, of course, the ovaries also make progesterone. And then as you go down in that chain of production, estrogen is further down the chain. So when you take progesterone as a cream, the idea is that it can give your body all the hormones that the adrenals make except the pregnenolone, which is higher on the chain than the progesterone. So that's one theory that he had when he decided to promote it as a healthy thing. And the problem is that progesterone does seem to give you, like if your body has a tendency to make a lot of estrogen, progesterone will convert into estrogen, and so you can get a lot of side effects from it that are estrogenic side effects, like weight gain and sore breasts and certain symptoms that are not comfortable. So there's like a lot of things that you have to pay attention to. And so I don't recommend that a person take something like progesterone cream over the counter without having somebody who knows what they're doing with you to help you make sure that you're doing something that's not going to harm you or, you know, give you the negative side effects. And there are ways to either not have the negative side effects or do something slightly different. One of the herbs that I think has a lot of progesterone effect is an herb called vitex or chaste tree berry. And I've given it to women for hot flashes and for a lot of the missing progesterone symptoms that they tend to get in perimenopause, and it can make up for that. I'm not against hormones, so should I answer one of these questions?
Well, let me try to organize these. We're getting such great questions. So there are two that I'm giving to Dr. Stefanik about age, sort of age-related things, what to do. So I'm going to ask you to answer those.
Okay, so this has been a really hot issue because we've been trying to figure out, do the hormones affect women in their 50s differently from women in their 80s? So one woman said, golly, I'm 80 and I've been taking a low-dose Prempro every other day for years. Am I in trouble? And the answer is probably not, because if you actually have been taking it for years, you seem to be resistant to its risks, and hopefully you're getting its benefits. And we actually don't have data to say that we should have women stop hormones. Our data relates to should an 80-year-old woman start hormones, and the answer is clearly no. But we don't really have good data on should a 70-year-old who's been taking it for years stop, should an 80-year-old, even though physicians pulled all these women off it, that really wasn't the data that we created from the WHI. So probably not, but you know, hopefully you won't sue me if something happens. The other question is, I'm in my 50s, and I'm close to the medical definition of achieving menopause. My doctors have prescribed estriol and progesterol to alleviate my irritability, hot flushes, and insomnia. Does the evidence show that taking these meds put me at more risk for heart disease, dementia, etc.? What about the OTC progesterone cream? Any use for pregnenolone in this mix? So I'm not going to answer all of that, but I will say that when we talk about a woman who's in her 50s, the first thing to understand is that she's at pretty low risk unless she's got a lot of risk factors. And when you do the individual approach, you will look at what are your risk factors. What's your cholesterol? What's your blood pressure? What's your weight? What's your this? And you're going to then calculate, is this person at higher risk for heart disease? But most women in their 50s are at low enough risk that even if you increase your risk a bit, it's probably not going to be a serious thing. And so we all have risks that we're encountering all the time. And we talk about the absolute risk, which is what your risk is, and then am I going to increase it? So even if I increased a low risk by twofold, it's still low risk. And that's the important thing to realize when you're in your 50s. On the other hand, when you're in your 70s, a twofold increase is going to be a big deal. And so this is where we really are with respect to hormones, but I think lots of other drugs, is recognizing that we have to take into account what's the baseline and if we perturbate that. And one other question that came along was about OTCs, oral contraceptives. And again, they actually come also with increased risk associated with estrogen, but those women are even younger, and their risks are even lower, so even if you increase it tenfold, you might still be fine. That said, I have plenty of Stanford students who will tell me, I had a blood clot when I went on oral contraceptives. That's their genetic problem. And so we just have to realize that the individual is always going to be different from the whole population data that we have, or often will be different.
And so I think following up on that discussion, there are often women who are using the birth control pill for contraception, and when they get to late 40s, 50s, which is around the time of menopause, what do they do? Do they still need it for birth control? You don't know if you're on, and you're unlikely to be having the symptoms. Can they go off of it? And what will happen? And I think, again, people tend to approach that by saying, we want you to be on the lowest dose that you need at a certain point in time. And so you would work individually with that woman trying to assess the need for the contraception. Is it possible to come off of that, to maybe use something else to assess what you are, to be on a lower dose of estrogen if you find that you're needing it? So again, it's an individual decision looking at the reason for taking the medication, the risks and benefits, and how to move to a place where you may be wanting to come off of that given the risks as you get older.
Do you want me to take a question?
Yeah, there's several questions.
There's several questions. One that asks about homeopathic estrogen and progesterone and whether it works. And I don't know much about homeopathy except some very basic remedies. But the basic idea in homeopathy is that it's an energy medicine as well, that you take a tiny, tiny amount of something. Usually the theory is that you take a tiny amount of something that would ordinarily make you sick, or make you have the symptom that you're trying to get rid of, and then it solves the problem. So I have seen patients who do really well with homeopathy using a remedy called Lachesis for hot flashes. But I'm not familiar with using estrogen and progesterone, so I can't tell you whether I've seen it work in anybody. Then there's a question about how long does it usually take for Chinese herbs to work to stop hot flashes? And kind of it looks like the question is when to start thinking about bioidentical hormones. And again, I do this on a person-by-person basis. I have patients who absolutely refuse to take hormones, no matter what. And so with them, I will work until they feel better, no matter what, and not give them hormones if that's what they don't want. if I have a person who comes in and says, I want to feel better right now, I'm going crazy. I had a woman, but this was about 10 years ago, but she went on a trip to Europe, and the flight somehow triggered menopause, and she started going crazy in Europe, and she was with her husband, and she came back, and she was like, I can't stand it. I'm going crazy. And she literally, she felt like she had lost her mind, and I don't know if any of you have had that experience with perimenopause, where it suddenly feels like you can't control your emotions, and you can't control... I've had it, so. But, so I gave her hormones in the first visit because she needed to feel better pretty quickly. And so she felt better within a week. And, you know, with each person, it kind of depends. You know, like herbs, they take, you require taking them a couple of times a day. And sometimes they work within a week and sometimes they work within a month, and sometimes bioidentical hormones take a month to work, and sometimes they take only a week to work. So each person is so different, it's really hard to decide. And then there's one more question here that I think I should answer, and that is about the Wiley protocol. Are you familiar with the Wiley protocol? The Wiley protocol is, you guys are probably, yeah. It's a system that was written about in a book by Suzanne Summers, who talked about how she cured herself of breast cancer using bioidentical hormone creams. And this person named Dr. Wiley, I'm not sure she's even a doctor, and I think she's an anthropologist. I think she's an anthropologist. Developed this system of using hormones and giving a really, like trying to cycle your body as if you were 20 years old and giving the doses that your body would have when you were in your 20s. And, you know, I'm completely against that because our bodies aren't 20 when we're in our 50s. And so my personal belief is that nature takes us down a path for a certain reason. So you want to match, you want to feel as good as you can possibly feel in the moment that you are in. And you want to maximize how you feel in that moment. But you don't want to take your body back to 20. That's not natural. That's not biological. It's not bioidentical. It's not what your body's supposed to be doing when you're 50-something, right? So that's my answer to that. And if one of you wants to answer that too.
So we are going to run out of time, be given the hook, I know. So I just want to address a few more of these, and then I'm certainly willing to stay around for a little bit longer to for people who we didn't address the issue to come up and talk about it. One of these that I think is important because it brings up the whole question for me of looking at the symptoms within the context of other things that may be going on. And the question is, would you comment on the thyroid in the context of menopause, any links between menopause and the thyroid? And I certainly think that thyroid disease can mimic some of the symptoms that women complain of going through menopause. So it's really important that you see someone and that they do a complete history, a physical exam, and get appropriate laboratory tests, because you don't want to be treating menopausal symptoms when it's as menopause and not excluding something else that could and should be treated that can make you feel better. So I think that's true of thyroid disease, and it's also true of other possibilities. I have a couple of questions here that are similar, which is really about, I think, getting back to this question of people's experiences don't match the textbook definition of what menopause is. So one is it possible to have perimenopausal symptoms and still have entirely regular menstrual cycles? And the answer is yes, that the thing that may, for some women, that can occur first is a change in their menstrual cycle, and for others, it may be starting to experience the symptoms because of the fluctuation or change in the way the hormones are in their body. So the answer is yes. I still have heavy periods, 52 years old, and have menopausal symptoms. Yes, that's possible. I've not had had hormone levels tested. Is the saliva test accurate? That's not a test that I use typically. I don't know if you do in your practice. I think one of the things that is important that you mentioned is that you can do individual tests. Some of the individual tests that we have that can give you a definite diagnosis of menopause when you've sort of completed the perimenopause and your ovaries have stopped producing any estrogen. But in that lead up and in that perimenopausal time frame, you can get a normal FSH, which is the typical test that we're looking at, but that doesn't mean that you're not going through menopause. So that shouldn't be the end of the story when that test is gotten. You want to be working with a doctor who is hearing what you're saying and listening to the symptoms and working with you on the basis of the symptoms. So we actually don't test hormone levels very often because what helps us more than the hormone level is you and listening to you and putting that within the context of what we know.
And I just want to say the study of women across the nation has really given us a very new perspective of menopause because the literature back when I was studying this 25 years ago, we kind of had pre- and post-menopause. And we forgot about the fact, wait, there's this transition. And the transition they used to talk about being like 3 years. And now what we know is that there's about 10 years on both sides, and it's a long continuum. So we don't just fall off a cliff and one day we're menopausal, even though we have this definition of 12 months past the last menstrual cycle. Yeah. Lots of women will have heavier bleeding, lighter bleeding. They'll still have bleeding. And they're already experiencing these symptoms. So what I think is important is that we need to understand the real physiology of the temperature changes. There's lots of new drugs that are coming out. We haven't even talked about them that are looking really at the neurochemistry and trying to understand what's going on with temperature regulation. We have very little information about that, and they are working. So some of them are actually FDA approved for dealing with bipolar disease and schizophrenia, but like venlafaxine, are actually showing to be helpful. So I think a lot of the mind-body things and the spiritual things may, in fact, help us energize those other chemicals. And I think that we're kind of in an exciting phase now where we're going to really understand it because estrogen is not the solution to the problem. That said, I think you heard that it works pretty quickly and it's very effective for many women. And as long as you have something that tempting, then you're going to want to take it. And that's why we really have to be clear on there are risks and then try to do our very best to figure out what are those risks and are they different for different estrogens. We're never going to get to study them all, just as Dr. Milliken said.
I'd like to say one concluding thing off of this comment. Not really a question, it's a comment. I went through menopause easily. I think it says with lots of hot flashes and did nothing special. Now I'm physically the healthiest I've been in a long time. How come so many women fight nature as if we are taught menopause is a disease? I have really two comments on this. One, I think the panel tonight and I think the experience in the room reflects that the experience is really varied. For some, it's not a single symptom, and for others, there are a lot of symptoms that need to be dealt with. So that people need to recognize that the experience is common, but it's also individual. But I very much want to address this, that women have been made to feel deficient by describing menopause and postmenopause as a state of estrogen deficiency, which did make women feel as if they had an illness or vulnerability or were aging or washed up or whatever the things were. Well, pre-puberty is also an estrogen deficient state, but we don't call children abnormal. So I think it's really important to realize that that's the natural phases that we go through, and the transition, as I said at the beginning, the transition of puberty and adolescence. How many people in here had a turbulent adolescence in terms of their hormone? A few. So the same happens on the other side. But so those transitions can be turbulent and need special attention. But once you get into the steady state of the next phase, it can be a very healthy, satisfying phase of life with a lot of advantages. So I think that's the way we want to look at it, and medicine and other healthcare providers are here to make that transition the best and the healthiest for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to our panel of distinguished speakers, Dr. Marcia Stefanik, Dr. Shiroko Sokic, and Dr. Nancy Milliken for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.